Afternoon. I'm Alice Sheridan, and I'm here with Martina McGrath, and we are interviewing our most recent guest editors for the upcoming issue of NEFSAP and Transplantation. Those guest editors include Dr. Winfred Williams, Dr. Sumeet Mohan, and Harsamar Ahuja. All three wrote the editorial. Which we read with great interest. As many of you know, Dr. Williams has a long and esteemed pedigree. He graduated from Harvard College and then from NYU School of Medicine. He completed his residency and fellowship in renal and transplant at Brigham and Women's Hospital. He is currently the Associate Chief of the Division of Nephrology at Massachusetts General Hospital and an Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Winn is the founding director of the MGH Center for Diversity and Inclusion, and he has a long foundational track record at MGH in the development of programs that enhance the diversity of the physician workforce there and at Harvard Medical School. And certainly over the last two decades, Winn has been instrumental in developing initiatives that support hospital-wide diversity goals and health policy that address disparities in the care of end-stage kidney disease and organ transplantation. Dr. Sumeet Mohan, our guest editor, is a professor of medicine and epidemiology and the medical director of the kidney transplant program at Columbia University in New York. Dr. Mohan's clinical and research career has focused on lowering health disparities and improving outcomes for all patients with kidney disease, but particularly improving access to transplantation and organ utilization. Harsamar Ahuja, also known as Seema, earned her Bachelor of Science in Neurobiology and Physiology from the University of Maryland and worked as a kidney transplant researchist under Dr. Valeria Moss at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. She's currently pursuing a master's in bioethics at Harvard Medical School, studying with Dr. Williams, focusing on xenotransplantation, advancing kidney equity, and exploring ethical solutions to the organ shortage and resource allocation challenges in transplantation. Well, thank you very much for being here and for your time this afternoon and for your excellent editorial. I'm going to let Martina take the first question, and then I'll throw in my questions as they come up. Martina?
Great. Thank you very much, Alice. Welcome, everyone. And I just want to echo the sentiments. Thank you very much for your time and efforts on this really important editorial that I think has laid out a lot of a lot of the issues that face our field. Dr. Williams, perhaps maybe I could start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about what are some of the still outstanding barriers to transplantation that we see in minority patients?
Yeah, so Dr. McGrath, thanks very much for the kind invitation to have us join you this afternoon on this podcast. And it's really our privilege and honor to be here with you and present on this topic. And so I would begin by saying, just from a 30,000-foot view, Martina, since I started my career way back in 1990 after finishing fellowship, 3 years plus. The issue of equity in transplantation has been one at the fore of transplant medicine for all these 3 decades and beyond. And I think one of the sobering realities that we face today is that still there are many deep challenges still that beset our community to achieving the goal of health equity. And it has been in my view, a fairly intractable problem, despite many solutions that have been brought to bear to address disparities through the years, even beginning with my tenure on the Minority Affairs Committee for the OPTN, the Organ Procurement Transplantation Network, The Minority Affairs Committee was one committee that set forth policy for the nation in addressing disparities in access to kidney transplantation. And still, that work, as productive as it was over, again, the last 25 plus years, we have not closed the gap in terms of health equity for patients and communities of color. And that still is a great challenge. I think one of the best testaments to this effect is the recent committee effort, a year-long committee effort by the National Academies of Sciences and Medicine, realizing the promise of equity in the organ transplantation system. This year-long hearing of health experts and transplantation patient advocates, other stakeholders, identified that there's still deep systemic and structural impediments in our system to achieving this goal. So I want to finish there, just sort of setting the table for, again, what has been a longstanding challenge for us through the years. The central tenets around which this is built is that one, before one realizes the opportunity for kidney transplantation, which is the best practice for renal replacement therapy, one has to get referred for evaluation. One has to go through that labor-intensive evaluation, looking at whether, in fact, a potential candidate is heart healthy, whether they have the appropriate vasculature to receive a kidney transplant, whether their metabolic capacity is such that they will do well post-transplantation, making sure that they don't have chronic indolent infection or cancer. It's a laborious evaluation process. And once you're deemed eligible for transplantation, then it's a matter of getting placed on the waiting list. And thereby, you have to go through a selection committee process where experts around the table deem you fit to be eligible to be waitlisted. And then finally, there's the matter of waitlisting before one realizes the first kidney transplant. So those, there are tiered barriers, if you will, or stages that one has to surmount before realizing the benefit of this therapy.
Where's the biggest stumbling block?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Dr. Sheridan. I think that's a very interesting question and a challenging one because we don't have complete data, for example, as to how the referral process is adjudicated. But at each tier, there are substantive barriers, and perhaps my colleague, Dr. Mohan, can give us more color on this question. But I would say that probably I think one of the great challenges is getting referred for in the first instance. Now, I will tell you that, and there's a lot we could be here all afternoon. But in terms of what's been done to try and address these challenges, I would say the first big effort that looked at reengineering the kidney allocation system was the kidney allocation system in 2014. It's called CAS, where those deliberations really took a decade to come to the table with many stakeholders giving testimony as to what needed to change in the system. And CAS put forward a number of new objectives in terms of how equity might be realized. For example, waiting time was adjusted. And waiting time means when you get on the waiting list, that's probably the biggest contributor to one's transplant candidacy. Here, prior to 2014, you had to be referred for evaluation before you could get established as someone who's on the waiting list and winning, accruing waiting time. In 2014, the waiting time adjustment was such that once you're on dialysis, no matter whether you've been referred or not, or if your estimated GFR, this had been a longstanding tenet, was less than 20 cc's per minute per 1.73 meters squared, you are eligible for evaluation and waitlisting. And so that was one remedy that was put forth in terms of trying to adjust these, I guess, these tiered barriers, if you will. But Sumit, I don't know if you want to comment here.
Yeah, no, sure. I think that's a fantastic sort of overview of where we what the challenges are. I think there, I think of them in two buckets. There is access to transplantation for those individuals who are fortunate enough to get on the wait list. And then there's the challenge of getting onto the wait list itself, which is, sort of a its own black box. So what Dr. Williams described here is really fantastic work done by the OPTN and groups like the Minority Affairs Committee that change allocation policy in a way that allowed for greater equity for those people who are on the wait list. So immediately after CAS 2014, because of the change in how allocation time was calculated, what ended up happening is time, your clock, so to speak, for allocation time started at the time you started dialysis as opposed to when you were on the wait list. And so what that change does is it eliminates sort of the disadvantage of a delayed referral, right? So with this idea that patients shouldn't be penalized because their nephrologist referred them 3, 4, 5 years in many instances too late for transplant. So what that resulted in is a rapid bolus of a lot of these sort of late referral individuals early after CAS. And after that initial bolus settled out, we saw sort of a lot of, a much greater equity among white, Hispanic, and Black patients in terms of access to transplant on the wait list. But, the other thing that Dr. Williams mentioned is perhaps the bigger challenge today is how do we get access to the transplant? So we have 550,000 people on dialysis. We know for a fact that we should have many more people on dialysis on the transplant wait list than we do today. And the national transplant wait list is actually currently shrinking. So as a proportion of ESRD patients in the country, fewer and fewer patients are on the wait list. Now we've dropped to less than 1 in 8 dialysis patients is on the wait list. And that's a fu and that sort of rapid de deterioration partly is, a function of decreased sort of sense of urgency on the part of the referring team or the referring nephrologist to say these patients need to get on the wait list quickly, right? And the reluctance on the part of the transplant centers to wait list people when their workup is incomplete. But that's a good guess and nothing more. We have no data on where the attrition occurs in a multi-step process. Right. So people need to be referred. The referral needs to be accepted by the transplant center. You then have to go through a multi-step evaluation process, get to selection, and then get waitlisted. And every transplant center, it has a different level of selectivity, so to speak. Right. So much so that we know today, if you take our healthiest end-stage kidney disease patients, those individuals who are under the age of 40 and have no reported comorbidities other than hypertension. When you look at that subgroup, all of those people should be on the wait list, right? They're our youngest, healthiest ESRD patients. And yet less than 50% of those individuals make it onto the wait list, even 5 years after starting dialysis. So clearly we're leaving many suitable candidates behind, and doing them a disservice. And the OPTN is finally starting to work towards collecting pre-wait listing data so we can start to understand that center level selectivity and how it is contributing to these broad disparities, whether it's socioeconomic or racial or other forms of disparities, but nevertheless, disparities.
Thank you. I think one of the recent changes that we in the transplant field are very conscious of, and I'd like to highlight for the larger nephrologist group, is what's been done in terms of the race-free eGFR equation and how that's been incorporated into transplant listing. Could you expand on that a little bit for us?
Sure. So let me begin by saying that the classical estimating equations for assessing kidney performance, called estimating equations for GFR, included an adjustment for Black race, the result of which was to inflate kidney performance measures for patients of African and African ancestry, African Americans mainly, to inflate their performance metrics by roughly 15 to 20% on average. And so, in practice, this inflation factor would cause Black patients with advanced stage chronic kidney disease, who are identical to their white counterparts in age, comorbid conditions, and serum creatinine, to exceed the threshold for triggering evaluation. That threshold was set historically at 20 cc's per minute per 1.73 meters squared. So if you have 20% of kidney reserve function, you are eligible to be evaluated for a kidney transplant. These classic studies were derived and relied on small cohorts of Black patients. And the methodology as a whole, and this is harkening back to the 70s and 80s in the initial studies, had some flaws in methodology. And this sparked a call for systematic reexamination. And I would tell you that the systematic reexamination occurred really as a function of society's greater awareness that structural racism was really a very big challenge, not only in society, but also in the halls of medicine. In the aftermath of the 2020, as you remember, murder of George Floyd, there was an ensuing broad national and even international outcry for social justice and racial equity. And this brought into focus these so-called racial constructs in medicine, medical algorithms that included a race factor and might have had a disproportionate negative effect on communities of color. And so, again, this came to the attention of the renal community. And I would say these classic studies and their reexamination, multiple investigations in the 2021, 2022 period, spearheaded by, for example, Leslie Inker and Andy Levy at Tufts and Qi Xu at UCSF, laid the groundwork for developing new estimating equations that eliminated the race coefficient. And then also to look at an examination of so-called race-neutral biomarkers such as cystatin C. And we wrote about this, we published this in the New England Journal of Medicine in these two seminal works that led to the establishment of the CKD, the Chronic Kidney Disease Epidemiology Collaboration, CKD Epi 2021 equations, which were refit without a race coefficient. Now, this has made a impact, I would say, a big impact nationally, mainly in large academic medical centers in terms of rolling out policy initiatives to incorporate these new standards for measuring kidney performance in populations of patients of color. The Organ Procurement Transplantation Network, the OPTN, issued the modified waiting time for candidates affected by race-inclusive estimated GFR calculations, that policy in 2023. And it mandated that U.S. kidney transplant programs identify Black candidates whose waiting times were affected by race-inclusive estimating GFR calculations and to adjust their waiting times accordingly. And I would say, as a result of that policy initiative, just looking at waiting time alone and establishing the appropriate thresholds for candidate evaluation, that's led to an increment of about 10 to 15% of Black patients now realizing kidney transplantation. A number of studies, and these were mainly single-center studies, looked at, including Mass General, in my hospital, Mass General Hospital, looked at backdating their Black candidates according to these new estimating equations. And generally, Black patients gained on average about 1.7, call it 2 years of waiting time once you did the backdating calculation. And that is really quite a gain in terms of waiting time accrual.
Thank you very much. Some other innovations that have been developed more recently in terms of kidney allocation, I think, have tried very hard to address some of these disparities. Can you tell us a little bit about what's been done and what are the kind of remaining challenges to be addressed?
Sumit, do you want to just chance take a stab at that?
It's a big question.
I would just
Let me
say,
pick an
Martina,
area.
it seemingly is never enough, but go ahead, Sumit.
I was going to say that there is a lot to be done, but that I don't mean to discount kind of the effort that's been ongoing, right? So I think the OPTN and the kidney community in general has been doing a lot of things to try to understand what the disparities are and how we mitigate them, right? So part of the challenge is we haven't measured it well, at least in the pre-transplant, pre-waitlisting phase. So there is currently an ongoing effort with HRSA and the OPTN to start collecting pre-waitlisting data. In fact, that data element for pre-waitlisting data are currently out for a comment from OMB. That comment period ends in early January. And so we hope to start collecting data at some point in 2025, which should start to give us more insights into how people get access to the waitlist. So I think that capturing that data is a important step. We've removed race from the KDRI equation, which I think was long overdue and probably it happened too slowly in my opinion, but nevertheless it has happened.
Sumit, you might want to explain the KDPI and what it is.
Okay. So as part of the way the allocation system works, we have what's called a kidney disease risk index, which is basically a relative risk of graft failure for a given organ when transplanted in the average patient. That then gets converted into a percentile based on last year's sort of organs procured. So that's a long-winded way of saying we now have a approximate measure of organ quality, which we rank on a percentile scale, one being the best quality kidneys available, 99 being the lowest quality kidneys that are procured, but still suitable for transplantation by an OPO. Now, this measure is essentially a composite of multiple factors, some demographic factors, anthropometric measurements, clinical comorbidities like diabetes and hypertension. Since we're talking about kidney quality, it includes creatinine, and things like cause of death. But one of the things that included was Black race. And so recognizing that that needed to be removed and we needed to have a race-free KDR equation occurred around the same time that we recognized that race needed to come out of the GFR equations. But we finally have implemented it. There's now a refit equation that does not include race for the KDRI and therefore the KDPI, which had just gone into effect a few months ago. So that allows kidneys to not have a so-called penalty for coming from an African American donor, right? So I think that's another step forward that we've made. On the policy front, one of the key things that that CMS has recognized is that we probably have never incentivized growth of transplant centers, right? So transplant centers frequently sort of because there's a scarcity of organs, because they're at the whims of the allocation system and getting organs offered to their patients, frequently have to predetermine what size transplant center they have, what kinds of resources they have. And so they all aim for a certain number of transplants to be performed in a calendar year. And when they do that, what happens is you set yourself a goal and you say, I'm going to do two, as a transplant center, we're going to do 200, 250, or 100, whatever that number is. And that's what they're set up to do in terms of the size of the pre-transplant team, the size of the post-transplant team, the number of surgeons they have available. And so what that has inadvertently created is sort of a cap on how quickly transplant has grown in the country. The majority of growth has happened in a relatively small number of transplant centers, and disproportionately for patients with private insurance, as an example, right? And much less so for patients with Medicare and Medicaid, the dual eligibles. So creating these sort of socioeconomic stratification in terms of growth, creating racial differences in what the volume of growth is, because there's also sort of regional variation in how many transplant centers exist and where these ESRD patients live. And so CMS has now recognized that as a problem and is actually incentivizing growth, incentivizing transplant centers to grow at a particular pace above the national growth rate, and doing that in a multi-year fashion should actually dramatically change what we are seeing in kidney transplant. So this new what's called the increasing organ transplant access model from CMMI includes 50% of transplant centers in the United States. They're geographically disparate, randomly assigned based on the erstwhile donation service areas, and this sort of growth will is just the latest, I think, in policy efforts to try to improve disparities in transplantation.
So if I can dovetail on Dr. Mohan's a nice explanation, a similar effort, and this is by Rachel Patzer, who's now at the University of Indiana, colleagues at Emory, and this is, I think, is a development that answers many of the mandates of the 2022 National Academy of Sciences Engineering Medicine report that highlighted difficulty in access to kidney transplantation. It's called the Early Steps to Transplant Access Registry, or E-STAR is the acronym, and it provides a model for how pre-waitlisting data can be used to inform quality improvement to drive equity and access to transplantation. It includes data from 37 transplant centers across 13 states and four regions: Southeast New York, New England, and the Ohio River Valley. And it represents about 200,000 patients with end-stage kidney disease treated in about 4,300 dialysis facilities, in addition to patients who are preemptively referred. And so this is a dashboard and a database that's developed as an interactive website offering center-specific and regional insights into pre-transplant access within and across centers, with the intention of improving minority access, generally improving access, but also focused on the disparities aspect, improving minority access to transplantation and pre-transplant evaluation.
If I might ask one more question from a clinician standpoint, much of what you discussed today addresses policy, health policy, nationwide, international, if you will, or individual transplant programs. And what about the practicing nephrologist out there? When I round in my outpatient dialysis, I have to check a box. Have you discussed transplant? Is this patient interested? And yet, this discussion should take place stage four, perhaps even earlier. What's the outreach to the clinician?
So if I can take just one stab at that, and then I would like Sumit to comment on the 2478 form in dialysis centers. I'll leave that headache to him. So I think one of the strategies that's emerged really in the past about 10 years, I'll call it 5 years, is this idea that we have to take transplant services out of the ivory tower of academia, academic medical centers, and to the community. And for example, at Mass General, we have an equity in transplant initiative that's a part of the Mass General Brigham United Against Racism strategic efforts. And so we've started an equity in transplant clinic in the satellite area of Chelsea, a small town that's a satellite to Boston and Mass General Hospital, that's predominantly ethnically Hispanic. And you're taking now services to the community where their providers engage with them in real time, with patient navigators there, with social workers that are bilingual and dedicated to assisting providers in making contact with patients and making sure that the patients understand that some of what's being offered to them in a way of increasing health literacy. And we're doing the same now in another satellite town to Boston called Brockton. in the Brockton area, where the majority of these patients are African American. So this is an idea of moving transplant services out of the hospital and the major transplant center, where people may have trouble getting transportation or time off or paying for services or spending an entire day with a labor-intensive evaluation process, but we're taking that process to the community. And in that way, engaging them, increasing health literacy, and providing services for people where they live. In terms of the dialysis center specific effort, 2478 Sumit.
But thanks. So I think you asked a very good question.
Thanks, but no
Right.
thanks.
Thanks. I think it's an important question, right? So I think there are two questions essentially rolled into your question. So first is, does the 2728 serve as a nudge for people who are not yet referred to transplant? And I think the new 2728, even though it asks multiple more questions, is geared to essentially do that. It is geared to nudge nephrologists to recognize that transplant is an important modality. It is a modality choice that we should provide. And so one of the new changes in the new 2728 is if you check off no that you haven't discussed transplant with the patient, you have to go back in 6 months and provide information about whether you have done it now or not. Right? And that is this sort of idea that we've stolen from behavioral economics to encourage nephrologists to say, can we nudge you in the right direction to have those conversations? So as flawed as the 2728 is, as cumbersome and as administrative as it is, it was seen as a potential opportunity for a tool. But the broader question around preemptive transplant, I think, is a more complex question. We should be referring patients preemptively. I think all of us on this in this conversation, most of our patients, given a choice, would rather avoid dialysis and want to get preemptively transplanted. And I think that's the right thing to do for our patients. I will say from an international perspective, where the only allocation system that allows deceased donor organs to be used for preemptive transplantation, right? And so there's been an effort to say, is that the right thing to do? And actually, the NASM report, I think, incorrectly suggests that we should get rid of preemptive transplantation from the deceased donor system. And the reason I think that's mistaken is, one, when we have preemptive transplantation as an option, it allows for much earlier conversations, as you correctly alluded to. It encourages patients to get to transplant centers and get evaluated ahead of time and get on the wait list. That entire cohort of individuals who is benefiting from the GFR adjustment, a large proportion of those people are preemptively waitlisted. And if they can avoid dialysis, they have the best outcomes with transplant. But it raises this sort of ethical quandary, right? Should we be giving these organs to patients who are not yet on dialysis, when we have hundreds of thousands of people on dialysis who would all benefit from a transplant? And the short answer to that question is, we should be giving it first to patients on dialysis. But the majority, the overwhelming majority of deceased donor kidneys used preemptively are organs that have been declined by transplant centers on behalf of their patients who are on dialysis. The number of kidneys that are transplanted preemptively to the first person on the list, where it's never been offered to a dialysis patient, is vanishingly small. And that number of kidneys is for people that we have prioritized in our allocation system, right? The highly sensitized, the kids, the people that we as a society think should be prioritized. Everybody else is getting a kidney that has been turned down by many dialysis patients above them in priority, right? And so it actually creates an opportunity for us to use organs that, for example, we worry are going to experience significant DGF or dense DGF for days or weeks. And so perhaps a preemptive patient's able to tolerate that better and use those organs. So, should we be talking to our patients earlier? Absolutely. Should we be doing more preemptive transplants? Absolutely. Do we do enough? No. And this is, again, an area where there are large both socioeconomic and racial disparities that we need to mitigate.
Let me build on that and just add 2 points. One, just by way of definition, preemptive transplantation is a transplant that's performed before a patient starts dialysis once the estimated GFR performance number falls to 20 cc's per minute per 1.73 meters squared. Once you hit that threshold, you're eligible if you're deemed suitable to receive a kidney transplant, and a preemptive transplant is one that occurs before a patient goes on dialysis. The second thing I would point out, I think I called it a 2748. Thank you, I assume it is 2728. So for that correction. Still, preemptive transplantation in the United States since 2014, CAS 2014, with all the directives, only another 10 years have elapsed. Have transpired. Preemptive transplant is predominantly a benefit, an opportunity that's realized by white patients and not minority individuals. In fact, the disparities between the two groups have only widened. And so that's still a challenge for us that needs to be addressed.
I think that's a great note to wrap this up on, where a lot of things have been done, but there are still major barriers outstanding and lots of work that continues to need to be finished. I want to take this opportunity to thank all three of our authors, and particularly to Dr. Williams and Dr. Moan for your time and your fascinating discussion and insights today. I think this will really add context to those who read our read our issue. So thank you very, very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
I think you can understand why I invited Dr. Mahan to be a part of this project.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Wynn.
Thank you all very much.
Thanks.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.